This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.
Our Ramser Artist of the Month for February is Amethyst Kia. That was Amethyst Kia's new single, Black Myself, out February 19th on Rounder Records, courtesy of Ramser Management. Pre-save the new single on Spotify and Apple Music today. Follow Amethyst Kia on social media, at Amethyst Kia, or visit www.amethystkia.com for more info. That's www.amethystkia.com. I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today's episode is a conversation with one of my favorite people to talk history with, my friend and colleague, Dr. Lewis Woods, who we've had on the show before. You may recall he put together the episode, the I Can't Breathe episode that came out last year in July. If you haven't checked that out, please do. He was also our guest on Road to Now number 118, where we discussed his research on the GI Bill and the way that it was unfairly given out after World War II in a way that has long-term consequences for Black Americans today. Bob and I invited Lewis to join us again. Aside from the fact that I keep on wanting to have him on episodes because, again, one of my favorite people to talk history with. But we wanted to recap what was going on in Georgia and other places with these election laws and just do a rundown of the ways these things have worked historically. Well, quite frankly, there's no question anymore. We have data that tells us what certain changes to the voting system will do and who it will affect. So we just wanted to talk about this and try to put it in historical context to talk about perhaps some of the changes that might actually improve this situation and reflect upon the current state of our nation in terms of the political parties. It was great to have everybody in the same room, and I hope you guys enjoy this. Before we go on, though, just want to upfront let you guys know about something we're excited about. We've mentioned it before, but it's beginning to take final shape. On May 2nd, 2021, Bob and I are going to be recording our fifth anniversary show. It's been 5 years since we began this podcast, and we have invited on an amazing list of guests to come in and do drop-ins, do 10-minute spots throughout the course of the show that we're doing. It will launch on the podcast feed a week from the day this episode launches, so it will be out on May 3rd. But on May 2nd, on that Sunday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time or 5:30 Pacific, we are going to be doing this live, and it's going to be a blast. We are giving first priority, as always, to our patrons, but then we are going to actually open up this live recording to everyone. We have limited seats. So, patrons, go ahead and sign up. We've got it posted on Patreon right now. You can go ahead and reserve a seat. We're doing this a little bit differently than we normally do, so we're asking you to register. And then on April 30th, that Friday, we are opening registration to the general public, to anyone who listens, to come sit in on this Zoom webinar as we run it. And so far, here's our guest list. This is amazing. We have Senator John Hickenlooper, Heather Cox Richardson, Matt Negrin, Doug High, Jefferson Cowie, so far have all confirmed. And this is an amazing list. So we're going to have them dropping in. We want to do it party style. We're going to center it around one question that we're going to ask every single person. And the question is, what has been the most surprising turn you've seen in the last 5 years that you never expected to see? 5 years ago, you didn't see this coming. but a turn in politics or in your occupation or anything. And how has that unexpected turn changed the way that you understand the past? You know, what do you see as the most important moments? How has that changed? And I can't wait to ask these people this question. So come join us. If you are one of our patrons, please sign up. You got the priority. And then the rest of you guys, look for our social media. Follow us at @road_2_now on Twitter and Instagram. And like our page on Facebook. And keep your eyes open on Friday morning, the 30th of April, for a link to join. We know that we have a few more seats available than we do patrons at this point. You know, maybe we won't by then, because if you join us on Patreon before then, you definitely get a spot in. And you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/theroadtonow and join us there. And again, you'll get guaranteed access to this conversation we're having next week, but you'll have access to join us in the room and ask questions in the Q&A for all of our upcoming episodes that we do webinars for. So you'll have a priority there. And on top of that, you'll get to be part of our third Thursday Trivia Nights, which is hosted by me and which has been a blast. Thanks to everybody for coming out to those. So there's a lot there, extra episodes and really a lot. So we're proud of what we're doing there. We hope you'll come join us. And if not, we think that if you join us for this party, you want to be part of the community. So again, look out for the post on Friday, April 30th on our social media for how to register. And patrons, get in there now. We want to have you there. So we hope to make this fun. I think we're going to have cocktails and drinks. It's just going to be a great party with some of the smartest people I know in the room. So Bob and I are really excited. So follow us for that and enjoy this conversation with the always brilliant Lewis Woods. Bob, tell me about Sunset Lake.
Sure will, Ben. Sunset Lake CBD is a farmer-owned business that ships CBD products directly from their farm to your door. For years, Sunset Lake was a Vermont dairy farm producing milk for Ben & Jerry's ice cream. In 2018, they diversified and started growing hemp for CBD. With a product for everyone, they offer pre-rolls, hemp cigars, and hemp flowers, as well as tinctures, gummies, and CBD coffee crafted to help with stress, aches, and pains. I've got a few of those myself right now, turning 50. It all just kind of turns on overnight, it seems like. Sunset Lake CBD saves you money by shipping high-quality CBD products directly from their farm to your door. Ben, what products have you been trying out lately? What's the kind of experience you've had with them?
Oh, well, I mean, the oil. And this is what I love, and I've been saying this before, is that like CBD oil has so many benefits, right? And personal experience, right? I've seen this. The problem is knowing which one to get. Like, that's been my thing. It's like I'd wanted to order some, but it's like, who do you trust, right? It's hard to find that out. And so I was kind of like between. These guys came on to sponsor us. They sent an awesome box of all these products. They've got Keef Bunts, they've got oils, they've got gummy bears. And like, I am into the oil. I like the oil, right? So I tried the oil, slept like a baby. I mean, like, my wife's been taking it. She sleeps well too. Both of us, you know, have our own weird sleep issues, but my deep sleep's up. And then for the other things that I don't use, I gave to friends. And I was like, tell me, because, you know, we take on sponsors we like. And all the feedback was like, this is amazing. And so I'm just really proud to have these guys on. If you want to give them a shot, go to sunsetlakecbd.com. That's sunsetlakecbd.com. And you can use promo code RTN, just the letters RTN, for 20% off your purchase. Just go there, sunsetlakecbd.com, and sleep better. Our guest today, we'd like to welcome back to the podcast, multi-time guest and the only person ever to host their own episode of The Road to Now that did not include me and Bob, and I think still one of the best episodes ever, The Road to Now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Dr. Lewis Woods.
Hey, gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate y'all.
We're grateful to have you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and for those of you guys listening, this episode is not officially, but it is basically an MTSU promotional episode because Dr. Woods is my friend and colleague and my neighbor, kind of like we live close to each other. So there's a lot of home here. I'm proud to have you on the show again so we can break down what's going on with voting right now in America. Just to start this off, right? We have this new voting law that's going into effect on July 1st in the state of Georgia. The background to this is Well, I mean, I don't know how else to break it down except for people in power in Georgia who did not like the outcome of the last election, even before it had happened, sowed seeds of doubt, encouraged people to doubt the legitimacy of the election, and have now proposed that a bill limiting voting rights is actually a cure and a remedy to the concerns about the voting system that they themselves created. So let's talk about what's going on there. What's going on in Georgia?
So according to the New York Times, they did a great breakdown of the bill, and they've identified 16 key provisions of the new Georgia voting law. I can go through them. We can go through them one at a time and talk about it. But essentially, this is solving a problem that doesn't exist, which, you know, everybody from the cybersecurity in the United States after the 2020 election said there's no real voting voter fraud going on in the United States. When Trump was elected, he impaneled his own voter fraud commission that was led by Vice President Pence at the time and Chris Kobach from Kansas, former Kansas Secretary of State. And they closed up shop because they couldn't find any legitimate, you know, there's a little bit of fraud here and there, one or two votes, one or two situations, you know, kind of crooked situations. But across the board, there is not this systemic problem of voter fraud in the United States. So this Georgia bill that was recently passed is a solution searching for a problem.
And, you know, one of the problems with it is that this is proposed as some type of a remedy for this problem. As you, again, right? A problem that there's no evidence that exists. But whatever the problem, this the cure is, hey, we've seen it before. We've seen it a lot before. We have seen the same ingredients and the same cure over and over and over again. And the cure seems to have a disproportionate effect upon certain members of our citizenry, I should say. Lewis, why don't you break this down?
Man, it's not new. Before we speak specifically about, 15th Amendment, other examples, one of the things that's interesting to me is that broad concerns, big picture, America's always been democratic for white men and aspirationally democratic for everybody else, right? And so we, you know, profess to be about democracy, but the reality is the struggle has been real to have democracy access to the larger, broader population, right? So we know 15th Amendment 1870 gives black males the right to vote on paper. And as long as the Union troops were here to basically oversee the sanctity of the elections in the South, we know that the 15th Amendment was, people had access to the vote. The struggle is after the Union troops leave, even though you have on the books this constitutional amendment, there are a whole host of legislation that's passed, literacy tests, poll taxes, grandfather clauses, and others that are surgically remove access for people of African ancestry from the vote. And so this isn't new, right? I mean, and again, even the 15th Amendment was 50 years before the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, right? I mean, and so we're talking about people who initially gave, you know, 5 years out of emancipation, gave the men, African-American men who were former property, the right to vote before wives, sisters, daughters in the broader white population, right? I mean, and so this is a struggle. And even when the 19th Amendment was passed on paper, everybody who is of color would have been able to access the vote. But we know because of these other discriminatory, provisions that doesn't happen until the Voting Rights Act of 65. Right. And so this is the bigger issue. What we're seeing in Georgia is essentially it's not new. States like Mississippi and South Carolina, which had majority black populations, use these kinds of shenanigans. Voter ID laws and some other laws are kind of the new poll tax 2.0, right? Literacy tests 2.0. It's a mess. And it's unfortunate because I think what we're seeing as demographics shift is you could do one of two things if you are in the Republican Party. You could either try to appeal to a broader population, or you could try to limit the access to the vote. I think we see which one they're going with.
I think one of the things that that surprises people when you dig into the 19th Amendment and the push behind that, one of the things that surprises people is that if you look back, the South, Southern senators, they are the most ardently opposed to women's suffrage. And it's like at first glance, because we do this in my classes, right? At first glance, people are like, well, why is the South so solidly against this? And they'll kind of like, well, maybe they're more concerned about men and women. And then you look at them talking. And to them, and they say this, several of them, it's their rhetoric that a vote for the 19th Amendment is a vote for the 15th Amendment. And that if you start ensuring that women have the right to vote, there are white women with access to resources. If they are denied the vote, they will make a stink. And if that gets federal officials into the South, it's going to draw their eyes to what is happening at the voting booths to Black Americans.
Yep.
It's so ingrained.
Dr. Woods, earlier you were reading some of the codes from Tennessee law.
Yep.
In the 1800s. Could you share them with our listeners?
Sure. So I was doing some research in the Tennessee State Library and Archive, I came across a document from 1875, and the document was an attempt essentially to discriminate against people of African ancestry, right? This is 21 years before Plessy versus Ferguson, which makes segregation the law of the land. And they were trying to deny access to people of African ancestry for innkeepers, amusement parks and stuff. And so they reference a couple of issues. They're always referencing without regard to race, but they say basically you can exclude at the discretion any person or persons whose hair has a spiral curvature not greater than 1/4 of 1 inch in radius, right? Without regard to race. They talk about occipital bones without impinging on the heel. They get very specific of such persons, right? Without regard to race. They go in detail about cheekbones, about feet. They talk about glands and I guess the stomach nerves excited to nausea in reference to, I guess, the way people smell, thinking about farm workers. And then this last piece, they talk about whose ancestors were cannibals or guilty of voodooism without regard to race. And so they go into great detail essentially arguing that we're trying to identify people of African ancestry, right? What we identify as stereotypically African-American, you know, hair that's very curly, feet that are flat, high cheekbones, and then this ancestry to or perceived ancestry to cannibalism and voodooism. And so, yeah, I mean, this is not new, right? I mean, I think some of these laws that people are talking about, once you identify communities people are less likely to have vehicles. If you don't have a car, you're not going to have a driver's license. Some states pass laws where they'll say, you know, okay, driver's license is preferable, but gun registration permit is acceptable. But, you know, college ID, not acceptable, right? And so there's this strategic, almost surgical way to identify people that are more likely to vote, you know, in for the GOP, for instance, and, you know, young people of color are less likely. And so these laws are surgical, kind of like these laws were in the 1870s in the state of Tennessee.
Well, now that we've looked at that, let's look at the new Georgia voting law. There are strict new ID requirements for absentee ballots. Okay, ID. In some ways, you can say this is the least of all of them in terms of, sure, an ID to vote. Yeah, okay. Well, you know, however, who won't have an ID, right? Mm-hmm. And we had a situation in North Carolina where they passed all these voter ID laws, and then they closed the post office and the DMVs in certain poor Black counties.
Yep.
So right there, you're making it hard to get, you know, so where you think, okay, a voter ID, I could see people, you know, sure, but make those IDs easy to be. Everybody has that ID. You know, no one is excluded from that identification. Well, yep. Let's go
also,
on.
Can I just say this right now? Can I just want to add this right now? The amount of data that we have on people right now, the amount of information we have about demographics and groups, there is no question right now that you know who you are writing out when you make a law like that. Mm-hmm. There's no question. I just wanted to insert that.
Yep.
Nobody wonders.
Well, have you ever bought a concert ticket online or some kind of a ticket online when there's a barcode, right? So you've purchased this something that there can only be one of, right? And you know, you buy what's the ticket scalper? I bought football tickets for me and Sam a couple of years ago, and off one of those scalpers, and had a little barcode on my phone, and we went to the stadium, and they just wanded the barcode, and we were good, we were legal, right? Because there's only one of that barcode. Okay, so let's go to the next new restriction in the Georgia voter ID law, or the new Georgia voting law. It is now illegal for election officials to mail out absentee ballot applications to all voters. So think about this. If we all use that barcode technology, if they sent all of us a little piece of paper in the mail that had a barcode on it, why couldn't we just take that to the, when we go vote? Or why can't we mail that in and they want that? Doodaloop. And there's only one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Good point.
And I'll move on to the third. Drop boxes still exist, but barely, which means they greatly reduced drop boxes. So if you do get that ballot sent to your house, there are fewer convenient places to drop it off. They've banned mobile voting centers. I guess they had RVs that you could go vote at this past election. Early voting is expanded in a lot of small counties, but not in the more populous ones. This is what you're talking about with the strategic. Okay, so in the rural counties, we think northern Georgia, those rural. If you watched the Senate races where they talked about the white voters that Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue had to win those three or four counties at the top of the state of Georgia. They had to have strong turnout because that was the rural white counties. They have expanded early voting there, and they've reduced it in like Atlanta, places like that. Offering food or water to voters waiting in line, now it's a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody want to take a stab at that one?
Man, because, you know, you saw people waiting in these long lines and folks were encouraging them, here, let's get some pizza here. Let's get some water here. Let's make sure that you stay encouraged. If you're hungry, if you're thirsty, making that a misdemeanor. The struggle.
Lewis, have you ever taken your child with you when you went to vote?
No, never. I always go early vote and I try not to expose my kids to the process.
Bob, have you?
We have, yeah. We took Hallie and Sam to maybe we took them this year. No, it wasn't this year because it was all weird. It was probably the midterms.
No, I have. But I'm thinking, if you just, we could probably track this data down, but I'm just thinking, who's going to be more likely to have to take their kids with them to vote? Mm-hmm. It's going to be working people who don't have the resources to be able to have childcare. And so we have this law that prevents people from giving food or drinks. Now, anybody who's listening right now who has kids know that kids will not be thirsty and then suddenly got a drink or they're going to die and they're in their own heads. Or kids get hungry and they turn into monsters. Mm-hmm. So this is so you're talking about right there, taking away access to a resource that could make a difference, right? Because you may want to vote, but like your children being with you when something like that happens can totally change the game. I'm just throwing that out there. I mean, it's just like, you're not thinking, I don't think people are really thinking this through, who this is affecting.
Well, there's a provision in here now. What do a lot of people, they vote after work. What Ben's saying, you vote after work, you take your kids. Well, now, it used to be that polls were open in Georgia from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. But now, if the polling location chooses, they can close at 5 p.m.
Jeez. Right when people are still at work.
Yeah. And then my personal favorites of these, the Secretary of State is removed as a voting member of the state election board. What did we see in Georgia? What was that? Gabriel, God, what's his last name?
You talking about Brad Raffensperger?
No. Yeah. You're right.
The Secretary
right.
of
yes.
State.
It was the Republican Secretary of State who voted for Donald Trump. Yes, that guy. Mm-hmm. GOP-led legislature is empowered to suspend county election officials.
Jeez. Great idea. Great idea.
So I'll stop there. But we see, again, this example of what you were talking about, Dr. Woods, with the targeted carving out, just like gerrymandering, carving out to exclude certain populations from voting.
Oh, there's no question. And I mean, even something like, you know, on paper, historically, we think about like a literacy test. On paper, a literacy test sounds like, oh, okay, yeah, you want to make sure people can read if they're going to vote. But when you start looking at what the actual literacy tests entail, I have a literacy test from Mississippi that I use in class a lot. And I'll say this, if I were to take this with a doctorate, I would fail miserably. And one example of the one from Mississippi said, write and copy in the space section, and there's a blank, of the Constitution of Mississippi. So when you walk into the election booth during this literacy test, and they didn't administer it to many, many times to people who were white, people of African ancestry, they walk into a registration booth, try to register to vote. They're asked a random section of the state constitution, and they have to fill it out verbatim. And if they can, which would be remarkable, the next question is write in the space below a reasonable interpretation, the meaning of the section above. So you almost have to be a legal. I mean, how many of us, if they asked us that in Tennessee or in Georgia, could going in without knowing what part of the state constitution would be asked, could we register to vote? And miraculously, about 3% of Mississippi Black folks were able to register and vote with this in place, which is unbelievable.
That must have pissed people off, honestly. That must have been like, oof.
Well, they're studying the whole constitution, right? I mean, that's the state constitution. That's the only way you could possibly pass it, right? And so I think one of the things that we see is that when you have this legislation that has his history of being on paper, not immediately discriminatory, when you look at the practice of it, and I think also in many ways the intent of it, it is surgical to undermine the vote. And I think that as a nation, you know, in the next 20 years, we're slated to be a majority-minority population. I think the country can go one of two ways, right? We can expand the democracy to include many, many people, or we can kind of go by way of the apartheid system where less and less folks, a minority still rules in a democracy. And I think that we have historical examples in this country where communities that were dominated by people of African ancestry, right? Mississippi and South Carolina historically, when Black people were able to vote, they voted in the first senators in the country. Hundreds of folks at the state level in many places in the South were elected during Reconstruction, right? And so that's another component where, in theory, you know, you say, oh, demographics are changing, we're going to get a different politics. We could, but we could also, this could be a dress rehearsal for some more stuff that's potentially to come. Because some of the most aggressive places in terms of these laws are, you know, Southern states that were either where Democrats either swept, like in Georgia, or were close to winning, like in Texas. You have these massive laws, right? And so, I don't know. Stay tuned. I don't know how it's going to end, but I do know that we, you know, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, and we have a lot of evidence of past behavior in terms of disfranchising communities of color.
Everyone listening, do you drink coffee? Yes. Yes, you do. I'm the only person who doesn't drink coffee very frequently. And I know that everyone else does because everyone else goes, why don't you drink coffee? Well, for those of you guys who...
why don't you drink coffee?
This is the only coffee I drink anymore. It's La Cosecha coffee, Bob. La Cosecha.
Great coffee.
That's right. I'm proud to say that we've had a sponsorship with them for a while. I have bags of their coffee here. And if you're ever stuck inside and you want to have some great way to start off your day, what better than having a good, nice cup of coffee?
I had bags of La Cosecha coffee, but I drink 3 pots of coffee a day and it went really quick.
Yeah. Well, if you drink a lot of coffee, that means you need to keep ordering it. And here's the beautiful thing. For those of you guys who are drinking coffee to get through the day, drinking coffee to get up in the morning, drinking coffee for any reason and you want a good cup, You can drink that coffee, support a small business that does good work and trade, does fair trade and takes care of the people that they work with. They have direct relationships with their farmers that they buy the beans from, and they do a fantastic job. La Cosecha Coffee Roasters. That's LACOSECHACOFFEE, LaCosechaCoffee.com. Go to their website, help out this small business, get yourself some good coffee. And if you enter promo code, the letters RTN and the number 10, that's RTN10, you can get 10% off your coffee. And you can feel good about drinking it as you get stronger. Bob, does coffee make you stronger?
I think it makes you smarter.
What are you?
I'm sorry.
That's all right. So you're basically like, I've just been trying to figure out why he's not very smart. And the coffee is.
I didn't say that. You asked me a question. I answered.
That's fine.
Honestly.
No. That's an acceptable answer. I can't tell you what to say, Bob, but I can say that you should go to LaCosechaCoffee.com and order some La Cosecha coffee. Our man Jamie Jeske out there holding the fort down. We got to keep our small businesses going, and we love them. So LaCosechaCoffee.com, promo code RTN and the number 10, and order some coffee.
Dr. Woods, we saw a backlash. Again, I would argue a backlash against the election of Barack Obama. And we saw it in the Congress with Mitch McConnell the day after he was elected saying, hey, he's going to be a one-term president, and preventing him from, you know, appointing judges and just an unwillingness to work with him on anything, right? Particularly in the Senate, particularly Mitch McConnell. And then we saw the election of the first African-American, I guess, senator. Is Senator Warnock the first ever African-American senator, or the first since Reconstruction?
I think it's the first. He's the first in Georgia, to my knowledge.
In Georgia.
But,
okay.
But I don't think he's not the first. He may be like the eighth or ninth in U.S. history.
And Senator Ossoff is the first Jewish senator from the state of Georgia in the South.
Which Georgia does not have the best history with treatment of Jewish citizens either.
That's right.
So this means something.
So the backlash is right in front of our face. It's in Georgia, it's in Texas, it's what we were talking about Arizona. We'll talk about that in a little bit, what's happening there right now. But do you see federal voting legislation as the only way to counteract this at this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. One of the things, so, you know, on paper, you know, and people like Malcolm X used to say this during the civil rights movement, if, you know, Black people were treated like citizens, you wouldn't need a Voting Rights Act to get voting when you have a 15th and a 19th Amendment, right? So the Voting Rights Act was important, especially the preclearance component, when you have a history of discriminating against and disfranchising certain communities. It makes sense to have federal oversight before you can change voter laws. Well, Shelby County versus Holder in 2013 basically gutted the preclearance component of the Voting Rights Act, which led to an abundance nationwide of the changing, you know, people who have a history of discriminating, not needing federal preclearance to change voter laws, started passing voter laws all over the nation. And so I think if there's not a re-establishment of federal, re-establishment of the Voting Rights Act or some iteration of a federal that supersedes state law, a federal law, I don't see how states that are essentially run by Republicans, and it's not to be necessarily marginalized or critique Republicans, but it is to assert that if you look at exit poll data, they have one group demographic in the country that votes for them in the majority, right? And so you see this as an issue where it's when it comes to people of color, overwhelmingly, they don't vote Republican.
Is it worth doing away with the filibuster to make it happen?
I mean, I think that would be an amazing opportunity, an option. But I think so part of the struggle is, the Senate in particular was designed to be kind of a very strong deliberative body, where we have lots of debate and discussion. But, you know, when you need 60, when 60 is the threshold, 60 votes is the threshold, I don't know you can get 60 senators to agree the sky is blue. You know what I mean? So part of the struggle is that oftentimes, you know, if you don't change the filibuster rules, and this is part of the challenge with the broader system, right? So how many of the last elections have Republicans lost in the general election numbers? I'm not talking about the Electoral College, but just the larger majority of the population. I think it's 6 of 7, 7 of 8. What is it? Do you know that?
They've won one popular vote in the 21st century, and that was 2004. Right.
Yes. Do you see what I'm saying? But we've had many, you know, we've had, you know, Al Gore won it, but didn't, you know, won the popular vote, didn't win it, didn't win the election with the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton won in 2016, but didn't win the election with the Electoral College. Part of the struggle with our system is we have major, large populations like California that have 40 plus million people, but they get the same amount of senators as, say, South Dakota.
Delaware,
right? Delaware, right? I mean, and so part of the struggle is that when this when you have everybody gets the same equal amount of senatorial representation, tiny places in the country have a amplified voice. And so then when you have people who are a little bit more conservative, and if you look at kind of where President Trump won in 2016 and 2020, it's largely in the middle of the country, south and the middle of the country. And so the coasts are very populated, but the representation in the Senate, at least, is a lot smaller. And so I think part of the struggle is if you have a galvanized opposition party, you know, it's hard to get 60% of the electors, you know, as the Senate, to be in any one party. And it's hard to get bipartisanship. I haven't seen bipartisanship since president before President Obama. I mean, it just seems like in the Senate, especially, it is a place where legislation goes to die.
Well, there was a time there was bipartisanship, and I think this is a part of this conversation. Right now, I guess the House passed DC becoming the 51st state.
Yeah.
And of course, Republicans are against that, but there was a time that Republicans supported it. In fact, Strom Thurmond supported it. Bob Dole supported it. Numerous other well-known Republican names. Kevin Cruz, the historian Kevin Cruz, tweeted an article from the 70s of Republican support for DC becoming the 51st state. But now this is another one of those battles, GOP battles against race, essentially, is now over DC statehood.
Yep. No, I'm with you. And I think I would love to see the filibuster happen. I just think the struggle is without it, it's hard to get anything done. And so maybe another state, you know, make Puerto Rico or DC get some more senator opportunities. Right.
Well really, and if you look at the Republican Party's recent strength with the Latino population, like they did very well in parts of Florida, parts of Arizona, as opposed to past elections, perhaps that could be like, because you could probably get a Republican congressperson or senator out of Puerto Rico in time.
Yeah.
DC, you know, it'd be unlikely.
Right. Exactly.
Well, let's not forget that, you know, we're like talking about the racial thing. Let's not forget that Strom Thurmond was one of several Southern politicians who tried to stop Hawaii and Alaska from joining the United States on grounds that they were not white territories. Right. So, I mean, we can't, you know, like now the racialization of D.C. coming in, it's just a thread. It's just a thread that goes all the way back. And, you know, people forget about these debates. You know, this is one of the things that Daniel Immerwahr pointed out so well in How to Hide an Empire. Race mattered then, too.
Yeah. There's no question. I remember, so before I taught at MTSU, I used to teach at UTEP in El Paso. And so when I went there, I was there from 2006 to 2007. When I taught U.S. history there, I brought up immigration, right? Because they're part of the wall that George Bush built was right through El Paso.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Yeah, right. And so I thought the students would be energized and engaged, and they were energized, but not in the way that I had anticipated. But what was interesting to me about that argument is I would pull up John C. Calhoun's Conquest of Mexico speech from 1848. And one of the things that he said in the speech was, you know, they were trying to determine the boundary between Mexico, southern boundary between Mexico and the United States. And Calhoun argued we want as much land from Mexico with as little people of Mexican ancestry. And his argument then was that they are too racially mixed to be included within the white population in America. And so his argument was we want, don't go down far into what's now Mexico to create the border, because it'll backfire in terms of the people and the population. And so I brought that up to the students and they were like, what? He said, what about? And I was like, hey man, it's not me. I'm just, you know, giving you an historical example, but it's to your broader point, Ben. It's just it's an issue.
Dr. Woods, when you hear the, like, you thinking about this DC amendment that was passed in the House and, you know, Tom Cotton's arguments against it or Ted Cruz's arguments against it, they're the cloak of the coded language with which we would use to discuss race, you know, between the late 60s or the 70s and then the 2010s is gone.
Yeah.
Right. It's becoming more and more just plain ugly, slanderous, or, you know, racial slurs.
Yeah.
Considering this year, the last time when you hosted our show, it was in the wake of the George Floyd murder. Mm-hmm. And, the awakening for so many of us that we needed to listen to Black voices. Mm-hmm. Right. So how do you feel, like, as an African-American, as an academic, about what you've seen since election day, not to mention the past year?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the challenges I've seen is, you know, I think about the difference between how the folks who ransacked the Capitol on January 6th and the insurrectionists who went in essentially talking about hang Mike Pence, like, you know, how making nooses in the National Mall, talking about doing really horrible things to elected officials, including Republican elected officials who they didn't feel like were supporting former President Trump enough. And then you juxtapose how the police allowed that to happen, how they opened up the barricades for those folks storming the gates. And you juxtapose that with the treatment of unarmed folks. The people who came into, for me, in the insurrection, I mean, they came in body armor, they had zip ties, they had
bear spray
and all kinds of, you know, chemicals there to do harm to people, were allowed to live and were allowed to leave without being really lethally confronted by the police. There was a couple of deaths in there, but I think about what would have happened if that same crowd was, you know, majority Muslim, that same crowd was majority Black Lives Matter protesters, how much different it would have been. And so I think one of the struggles that I've been kind of dealing with since watching all the inequities from COVID, you know, with Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and Dante Wright, there's too many to name, frankly. Thinking about how police often make the argument that they cannot de-escalate situations when they feel threatened by people of African ancestry. And yet when you had a crowd that was literally there to threaten, to undermine the democracy, somehow the de-escalation happened. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that it's hard because I think I've been more tired this year than I ever have been in my whole life, just because you watch what's happening in the country and you understand on some level that the way that people perceive you is often threatening, man. And whether or not you are a threat, perception in a lot of ways is reality, right? And so, you know, I'm an avid saver for retirement, have been invested for 22 years. I fantasize about where I'm going to go, where I'm going to live when I can be able to sit down and shut it down. And between the pandemic, the police shootings, the insurrectionists, there are days I don't know that I'll always make it to retirement alive. You know, it's a crazy thought, but not so crazy if you think about what's happening in the society and in the nation.
And you know, this goes right when you were reading the codes, the Tennessee voting codes from, was the 1870s? Was yeah. that? Mm-hmm. In the listening to the George Floyd, the Derek Chauvin trial, and the defense was making the point, well, he had to have that knee. He had to keep his knee on there for 9 minutes because, you know, sometimes people wake up right. and then they're ready to fight. And it's this idea. And they pretty much said it, this stereotype, this idea that black men have superhuman strength and not the intellect to control it.
Yep.
But both are crazy.
Yep.
But that to me was right out of the 19th century.
Sure. Sure. But that was the only thing the defense had was to make George Floyd seem like a permanent threat. Because everybody saw the video and they had, you know, the video that we saw that went viral was bad. But I think the back part, there was a from across the street video footage that came and they showed all three men on him. So what we saw was Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck as he's handcuffed. But the across the street footage showed essentially one man holding his legs, another man holding his hands, and then Chauvin on his neck. And so, yeah, I mean, the stereotypes, usually when somebody of African ancestry dies, there's a character assassination. Like they die. And then their character dies in the attempt for the country to rationalize and justify and support, you know, agents of the state, people who we give lethal force authority to use, right, in protection of people and property. And, you know, when you are a person who has not always been made to feel safe or protected around police, you know, an encounter can be terrifying, and you try your best to not, you know, live in perpetual paranoia. But, you know, the fact that Black people have had to create, you know, green motorist guides to stay safe is a testament to how treacherous historically this nation has been to people of African ancestry. And so to me, it's all related, right? I mean, to me, immigration issues and debates are often related around race, right? Can we assimilate people of Central and Latin American ancestry? Obviously policing, but voting too. And so I think part of the challenge is that as a country, as we grapple with, you know, the demographic shifting, white supremacy is not static, it's fluid. It adapts to the times, it changes, right? Slavery is different from segregation. Segregation is different than mass incarceration. It changes, but the overarching phenomenon stays the same. And that's one of the things I really like about Isabella Wilkerson's Caste book is that, you know, she makes the argument where she juxtaposes African-American experience in this country for, you know, 402 years with Jews in Nazi Germany and with the Dalits or the untouchables in India's caste. And the more you read, the more it's hard to argue her central premise, which is that racism is not just the actions of an individual or two. It's structural to the point that it essentially defines the nation. There's a NAACP document that I have that's awesome. It's not an NAACP document. It's actually a White Citizens Council document in the NAACP papers. But there's a man who's pro-segregation during the civil rights movement. And he says that he's leaving his church. His church, his religion is now segregation. He's giving all of his money to the cause. And he said something to me that stuck. And I think this is, it illuminates something that we're experiencing in the nation a little bit. He said, in America, America's like a seesaw. He said, when the N-word's up, the white man's down. And if you think about, you know, Pew and other reputable research agencies, when they have polled white Americans, the majority of white Americans today that they have polled express a feeling of being racially oppressed. And if one sense of status or one sense of identity is predicated on the marginalization of other people. It puts you in a almost in a confrontational stance in relation to those people. Like Toni Morrison once said, you know, if you have to feel tall because everybody else is on their knees, you have a very serious problem. And I think as a country, when we think about issues pertaining to race, there are a lot of folk who felt profoundly threatened by a rise of a President Obama, who felt profoundly threatened by the fact that a state that hadn't won, went Democratic in, you know, more than a generation was swept, right? In Georgia, for instance, right? Where you have an African-American and a Jewish American as the senators. And so I think if one's self-esteem is predicated upon being relatively higher in status than other groups of people, then you have essentially outsourced your self-esteem to the abilities of those people, or to the ability to keep those people in a subservient or marginalized status. And I think that is dangerous because nobody has a monopoly on talent.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Benjamin Sawyer. This episode was edited by Gary Fletcher, and today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Peggy Murray, Team Martin, Julia Adams, and Ann Williams and Frank Edwards. If you'd like to join us on Patreon, get bonus content, get extra videos, get access to our back catalog, and join us for our trivia rounds, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you want to know more about our podcast and quickly search all the content, check out theroadtonow.com, our website, which is really good. Why is it so good? Because it was designed by Seven Ages Design. Need a good website? Hit them up. If you like what you're hearing here, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. Spread the word to your friends, because podcasting, it's not just on the radio or TV. You can't just come across it. People know about our podcast because you helped us spread the word. So thank you. We'll leave you with some more music from our Ramser Management Artist of the Month, Amethyst Kia. Her new track's out this week, so go to Spotify and you can get this whole thing without me talking over the first part. For Bob Crawford, I'm Ben Sawyer. Take care.